Deep in the ocean, an orca pod is on the hunt. But these aren't your average orcas. These guys are organized.
Marketing team, did you get those social media posts scheduled for the seal migration?
Aye, aye, Captain. We even have an automated notification for all pod managers when they go live.
They use Monday.com to keep their teamwork sharp, their communication clear, and their goals in sight. Monday.com, for whatever you run, even orcas. Go to Monday.com to dive deeper.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor-in-chief of the New Books Network, and school is about to begin, so I imagine many NBN listeners who are teachers are putting together their syllabi, and we'd like to encourage you to put the NBN on your syllabi. There are over 25,000 episodes in the NBN library, each of them an interview with an author who really knows what they're talking about. No matter what you teach, you'll probably find something there that will be interesting to your students, so put it in the resource section of your syllabus and encourage your students to go take a listen. Thanks very much. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to a new episode on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Géraldine Gutfein. Today, I'm thrilled to host Michael Wilrich, a professor of history at Brandeis University. In today's episode, we'll talk about his recent monograph, American Anarchy, the Epic Struggle Between Immigrant Radicals and the U.S. Government at the Dawn of the 20th Century, which was published by Basic Books at the end of 2023. This is a beautiful, beautifully written book about immigrants who dreamt of a world without states and whose decades-long fight for their ideas helped pioneer the field of civil liberties laws in the United States. Wilrich was named a finalist for the 2024 Pulitzer Prize for History for this book. Michael, congratulations, and welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
So first of all, I would love to hear about how this most recent book fits within your broader work. You've published two books before that deal with topics related to legal history. So I'd love to hear more about how you came to the book and how your previous work has informed this particular monograph.
Sure. Thanks for the question. So I've always been a social historian, very interested in the ways in which ordinary people, particularly in local communities and cities, interact with the state. How they come into contact with legal institutions and legal ideas and begin to think of themselves as legal actors. And so my first book was about Chicago, or set in Chicago, is really about the emergence of modern ideas about the social causes of crime and the way in which those ideas, which really displaced older understandings of criminal responsibility that were rooted in the individual, displaced those in favor of new sort of social explanations of crime. That crime was caused by poverty and inequality and bad housing and poor education, or even by biological factors in the sort of eugenicist version of these ideas. And the book, which is called City of Courts, examined the ways in which these new ways of thinking about crime got put in place in legal institutions, municipal courts, systems of parole and probation, psychiatric testing of criminal defendants and the like. And I use those stories to sort of tell a broader story of the development of American law and society in the early 20th century. And then the second book was about, I wanted to examine kind of the ways in which ordinary people challenged or fought back against the state as in a period when the state is really growing in its reach in modern society. I was exploring a bunch of different possible sort of case studies. But what really concentrated my interest was the problem of compulsory vaccination. I started this work, about 15 years before the COVID pandemic. But it's a history of the last great wave of smallpox epidemics in the United States, which swept across the country at the turn of the 20th century. And led public health officials and the police to try to get the population vaccinated through compulsory vaccination mandates. And those generated enormous resistance in the form of local anti-vaccination leagues to which ran folks for office and funded litigation, but also kind of everyday forms of resistance. Parents keeping their kids out of the schools and launching school boycotts. The schools were a prominent site for compulsory vaccination, or mobilization in the streets of people opposed to compulsory vaccination, or just really everyday forms of resistance, running away from the vaccinators and the public health officials. That book, which was called Pox and American History, actually led me, I didn't really know it at the time, it really kind of led me into this project. As I was researching the anti-vaccination movement, I learned of the work of a young New York lawyer named Harry Weinberger. And Harry Weinberger was, still in his 20s when he represented a Staten Island man who was a government clerk, but also a parent of two young children. And this man, who was named Herbert A. Thorpe, sent his children to school on the first day of school in September of 1910 and sent them with a note. And the note said, "If anyone tries to vaccinate my children, I will shoot them." So very kind of bold.
A little hostile.
A little hostile. It turned out, as I researched this story in the New York newspapers, that Herbert A. Thorpe had a lawyer, and his lawyer was this young Jewish first-generation American who grew up on the Lower East Side, Harry Weinberger. Harry Weinberger was, I could just sort of see through the newspaper accounts, he was obsessed with ideas of personal liberty and of constitutional freedoms, and the Constitution and the Bill of Rights is a wellspring of all kinds of freedoms that, you know, judges of the era just didn't believe in.
Mm-hmm.
And so Harry Weinberger's papers, it's a long story, but Harry Weinberger's papers are at Yale University. And when I went to go look through these 50 boxes of papers, I really was just looking for the anti-vaccination materials, but I sort of roamed around a little bit of them. It turned out that he had many, many interesting clients, including Emma Goldman and Alexander Berkman, the two most infamous American anarchists of the early 20th century. So I sort of made a note to come back and say,
as we do in the archives.
As we do in the archives. As I came back years later to sift through this, I really became obsessed with the question of what is an anarchist, and what happens when an anarchist is someone who doesn't believe in law. What happens when an anarchist needs a lawyer? So that's really how I got to this project.
That's fantastic. And I have to say, we're going to return to the figure of Weinberger, and I want to talk more about the archives and the materials that you used. But the sources that you work with were unbelievable. The correspondence between Weinberger and Goldman and Berkman. I mean, you have just marvelous sources. So that was, to me, one of the strengths of the book. You're bringing those voices to life really, really beautifully. But let's talk about anarchists. Like, let's step back from the figure of Weinberger. First, if you could tell us in a few words what the anarchist movement was in the early 20th century, and also talk a little bit about the historiography, perhaps, because you note in your book, actually later on in the book, and I wasn't sure if this was in the context of World War One or American historiography writ large, but you note that American historians have overlooked anarchists. Mm. So if that is the case, then why is it that that historians haven't paid that much attention to this movement or to the individuals that compose this movement? And then that brings me to really the important question at the heart of the book, which is, why do anarchists matter? Why is it important for us to study anarchists today and to read your book?
Right, right. So I'll try to take this one at a time.
Many strands here.
So first off, what was the anarchist movement? So the anarchist movement was an international working class movement in the late 19th and early 20th century. It had its origins kind of in the same place that modern, classical liberal thinking and Marxian socialism did, right? In the age of revolutions, in the development of nation states, in the responses of people to capitalism and the emergence of capitalism and the various critical stances that that people took towards these developments. But the anarchists really pushed at the outer edge of the broader international socialist movement by with their demand that not only was the institution of private property grounded in violence and illegitimate, but the states, the very states and legal systems that supported the institution of private property were themselves illegitimate, unnecessary, coercive, fundamentally an obstacle to human freedom. So the idea that a Marxian critique might lead to a state was mm-hmm. repugnant to anarchists. So there was a European tradition going back to really Pierre-Joseph Proudhon in France, and then Bakunin and the Russian, and then Prince Peter Kropotkin, the Russian anarchist in the late 19th century, was really a kind of a wellspring of the ideas that that informed a transatlantic exchange of thinking. But the anarchist movement in the United States by the 1910s had about 100,000 adherents. This is a time when the American Federation of Labor, the biggest labor movement, had close to 2 million mm-hmm. members. So they're kind of at the fringe of all this. They're a much smaller group than folks who would have called themselves socialists during the period as well. But they are committed to these ideas that the institutions of modern Western civilization that people took for granted, nation states, borders, laws, police, organized religion, marriage, that all of these had to go, right? And that that the natural form of liberty was the best form of liberty, and that liberty was one of a total absence of hierarchy and authority, and where individuals were able to pursue their and maximize their potential and to form voluntary agreements with one another to create systems of production and so on. So it's very much of a utopian idea. Like many utopian ideas, it was kind of more powerful for its critique mm-hmm. than it was for its practical vision. So then the next, and it was a movement that in the United States was associated with immigrants, which leads to this big contention, political contention of the elites, that anarchists and anarchism was a foreign pestilence, brought to America. It was like a disease. Whereas I really argue in the book, it's one of the book's arguments, that the American anarchist movement was in fact made up of, yes, immigrants, but people who had largely developed their anarchist position and belief activities in response to American social conditions, particularly the police repression of the labor movement, sort of most notably, but also repression of free speech of many kinds that contradicted a long tradition of ideas of liberty in the United States. So that's the sort of what were the anarchists? And the next question was,
why do you think historians have neglected anarchists as the historical actors?
So there is a rich body of historical literature on the anarchist movement internationally and in the United States, and particularly some really amazing archival projects, the most important of which is the Emma Goldman Papers Project, which has been in Berkeley for decades, collecting material related to Emma Goldman, fragments of correspondence, government surveillance reports on her activities and so on from all over the world. And much of this material recently has been made available on the Internet Archive. So it's an incredible collection and very accessible, but it's also enormous. I want to say that historians haven't been engaging with Emma Goldman. In fact, there have been sort of several mm-hmm. generations of scholarship about her, some with a sort of new left lens, some with a feminist lens. But where I think I'm making my real contribution is in thinking about anarchism and taking particular anarchists seriously as legal actors and political thinkers, rather than sort of thinking about them in strictly ideological terms. I'm looking at how on the ground they interacted with state authorities, and how they, in particular, used the courts as platforms of propaganda, and also to create the leverage that they could, with really significant effects. So this is what I do think that this is a American Anarchy, the book, is a pretty significant contribution to how we think about and understand anarchism in the United States as a social and political and even legal movement. You know, totally ironic fact, right? Given the
rejection of
their renunciation of all things legal by the anarchists themselves. So that's the second piece of your question, and the third was, what do we do with anarchists?
What do we do with anarchists?
I think that was broadly. I mean, they really are, to sort of cliche, but they really are great to think with, right? They, especially for a legal historian like myself, to look at the American legal system in the what historians often call the progressive era, the early 20th century, which is known to be a period of real transformation and, the era of state formation, state growth, new social intervention. This is when the modern administrative welfare state was built in the United States. And it's a period in which the law, constitutional law, was really fundamentally transformed in a struggle over several decades in the early 20th century to accommodate those kinds of developments. To look at this transformative moment in the history of American law through the eyes of and the activities of anarchists was a very attractive thing to do. And it turned out to be a very, I think, generative and productive approach. And so
I concur.
Thank you.
I concur. Absolutely.
Yeah. So that's what I've done with this.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. And let me introduce you to a terrific new podcast series, A Sense of Rebellion. A Sense of Rebellion is a captivating new 10-part podcast from Yevgeny Morozov and our friends at Post Utopia and The Syllabus. A decade in the making, it began as a doctoral dissertation featuring a score by Brian Eno. That's right, Brian Eno. The podcast explores a forgotten yet fascinating countercultural project at the dawn of the digital revolution. From LSD and the Rockefellers to AI and the CIA, each episode blends drama, mystery, and meticulous archival research. Don't miss out on A Sense of Rebellion, available now wherever you get your podcasts.
Thank you. So now let's actually get into the details of it. And I want to go back to this idea of American anarchy. So the fact that, yes, this was a movement that was largely made up of immigrants, but that really their ideas found fertile soil in the U.S., within yes. U.S. territory. So I want to go back to the really the two main actors of the book. I would say there's three main actors in the book. You mentioned Weinberger, and then the two others are, of course, those what you call the infamous anarchists, which were Emmett Goldman and Alexander Berkman. And actually, you start the book with their the prologue is gripping. You start in 1919 when Goldman and Berkman are already in their 50s, and they're about to get deported back to Russia because both were Russian-born Jews. And then what the rest of the book does is really tracing the arc of their life and activism on U.S. soil. And you pretty much show through their activism and the trials and their responses to the trials and the rise of the surveillance state, especially during World War I, how we got to this fateful moment of them getting deported. So Emmett Goldman, I would venture to say, is far more well-known maybe among a lay public than Berkman. I feel like she's just a more known figure. So I wonder, before we get into their relationship to the law, if you could tell us a bit more about who they were, even though, as you said, Goldman is quite famous. But who were they? Where did they come from? When did they arrive on U.S. soil? And what ideas really, maybe let's frame it differently. What was their ideology when they were still in Russia? And how did their ideology evolve, as you said, you know, American anarchy in the context of the American labor movement? And finally, how did they actually go about fighting for these ideas?
Yeah, so it's a long story. But so Emma Goldman and Alexander Berkman were teenagers when they came to the United States. I think that's an important piece of this. They were, I think Goldman was 16, Berkman may have been 17. He was a little bit younger than her. They arrived, you know, separately, obviously, as immigrants through Castle Garden, before the existence of Ellis Island, in the mid 1880s, 1886, 1887, thereabouts. And they both came from families in Russia, in the Russian Empire, M. Goldman was born in Lithuania. Berkman had lived mostly in St. Petersburg, if I'm remembering this correctly. And both came from families that were dealing with a lot of downward mobility. Let's just put it that way. They had access to a classical education, and they were bookish. They were really smart. They had some privilege as children, but their lives were very unstable. They also came from households with very strong lines of authority that they bucked against. And Berkman had some experience as a kid back in Russia with the ideas of nihilism, which are quite similar, really, to some of the anarchist beliefs. He had an uncle who was a sort of a Russian revolutionist who was imprisoned for his political activities. So Berkman had some sort of proclivity towards that. He wrote an essay that got him in a lot of trouble when he was in school about the non-existence of God and so on. He tells a story in a very short piece of writing that he wrote when he was in prison in the United States. He tells a story about being in a library in Kovno, an area of Lithuania small city where Goldman herself, in fact, lived as a child. And he was in the library, and according to this story, he was considering at that moment, as he said, stealing himself from the state, stealing himself from Russia, which, I think he meant he was going to be conscripted in due course, given his being a young man. He was considering stealing himself from the state and going to America. And so he's reading the English language papers about America and came across a story of the Haymarket affair, the infamous execution by hanging of four anarchists in Chicago for their alleged role in a bombing that led to the deaths of seven police officers in that city. And according to Berkman's own story, he sort of looked over at another student in the library and said, "Hey, psst, what are anarchists?" And so that to me is a very telling moment that his first thinking about anarchism, or his first posing of that question, came in reference to this American event. And when Goldman and Berkman were both newly situated in New York, Goldman first in upstate in Rochester, but then moving to New York, and Berkman went straight to New York and became a member of the working class there. They both were stunned by the execution of the Haymarket defendants. They called it an act of judicial murder. Their anarchism was informed from the very start by an understanding that the American legal system was not fundamentally about rights, due process, equality before the law, but was in fact a tool of the capitalists. So they got involved in the anarchist movement in New York. They became associated with each other and with other leading anarchists like Johann Most, a German American anarchist who's quite famous and an advocate of terrorism. They themselves got caught up or came together in a plot to assassinate Henry Clay Frick, who was one of Andrew Carnegie's right-hand men. I tell the story of this in the book. Berkman goes, I won't give it all that away, but Berkman goes off to prison for that attempt, and Goldman remains behind in New York City, where she emerges from his shadow and from the shadow of Johann Most and becomes an anarchist speaker, and starts by speaking in German and Yiddish, but strenuously learns English and becomes a really well-known public speaker, and then a journalist herself of sorts, a literary figure. And by the 19-teens, she is, you know, extremely well-known, traveling the country on lecture tours. And he, having emerged from prison after 14 years incarcerated, he joins up with her again in New York, and they really become the heart of this local New York movement that has a magazine that hosts theater events, that creates their own school and cultural center, and when World War I comes, they become leaders in the movement against the draft, and that's how they really get into very serious trouble with the federal government.
And I actually, that's bringing me to my next question. But here I wanted to say that it's really hard to overstate how much of a celebrity she was. And I couldn't help thinking about, you know, what would Emma Goldman do in the age of social media? You know, I could already see her Twitter account. I mean, she, from you just grabbed, amazing orator skills, you know, a fantastic public speakers. The amount of energy that this woman must have had, always on tour, talking to large audiences. She was also, because she was surveilled by the state, trailed by this gallery of bureaucrats and investigators. And she kept on the fight. I mean, really, I thought this was just remarkable, seeing how savvy she was in really channeling this message to audiences all over the country.
But she was also very savvy about building a kind of coalition, is not quite the right word, but building bridges with folks who were not particularly sympathetic to anarchism, but were sympathetic either to other causes of which she was a part, such as the movement for birth control, which was to disseminate birth control information. Practical how-to information about birth control in the 19-teens in the United States was a crime. It was a federal crime to circulate it through the males, as we're rediscovering now with the efforts to restore, you know, reuse the Comstock law to go after any kind of abortifacients and other contraceptive information being circulated to the males. But at the local and state levels, it was a crime as well. And she really pressed the boundaries, but also built support through her birth control activism. She also built support by reaching out to folks in the sort of liberal, well-heeled class in places like New York City with appeals to their own sensitivities about what was called at the time Comstockery, right? The sort of regime of the censor, the efforts to police propriety in the arts, in literature, on the stage, and so on, and which offended even the many well-heeled folks who considered themselves, risque and enlightened and so on. And so they contributed money to her journal, to her legal defense funds and so on. She was very good at bridging. And so she could actually give a lecture at Carnegie Hall that would be attended by hundreds or even thousands of people ready to open their pocketbooks and contribute money to her campaigns. And then she could go downtown later that same night and speak in Yiddish at Forward Hall, right, down on the Lower East Side, to a crowd of working people. So she was very, very skilled at speaking across groups.
And actually, that's also another fascinating aspect of the book, which is their fundraising efforts. When they got into trouble with the law, which is something we'll talk about next, people, you know, both from within the elite and ordinary people, especially Russian Jewish migrants, actually, gave money, even small amounts, whatever they could give to Goldman's and Bergman's defense. A lot of people did, you know, whatever they had, they give it away to support the movement. And I think that speaks to the skills that you just outlined. But I thought it was very moving to think about those ordinary workers who probably had very little to live on, nonetheless donated to this cause. So let's talk about the law. And the first question here has to do with the kind of trials that they were involved in. Sketch out what of their ideas exactly posed a threat to the state as the state understood it. What kind of charges did local and federal authorities bring against Goldman and Bergman?
Yeah, so their biggest trial in the United States was their trial for criminal conspiracy to obstruct the draft. It's often mistakenly said that they were tried for under the Espionage Act, which was passed right before they were arrested. But in fact, that wasn't the charge. It was that they had conspired to obstruct the draft, and so criminal conspiracy to obstruct a federal law, and that was the law, that was the. They had been involved in forming an organization or a league. They formed many little leagues, one of which was called the Non-Conscription or No Conscription League, which was opposed to conscription specifically, to the registration and to raising consciousness. And as the U.S. entered the war in April 1917, and then quickly started to mobilize men for the war, they spoke out and had these big rallies across the city. And some of these rallies were attended by thousands of people, and would frequently result afterwards in clashes between the anti-war or anti-conscription activists and their supporters and the local police. But this is what they ultimately got brought up on federal charges for, was this conspiracy. And they turned their conspiracy trial in a way that I really kind of very much enjoyed telling in the book into a this kind of big public event that was covered in all the American newspapers, which were the internet of their day. I mean, really, across the United States, the front pages were covering this, were about this trial. And they turned the trial into, which they recognized was a foregone conclusion. Like, they had no illusions that they would ever win any trial. But as an opportunity to really spread their doctrine, which, while illegal, perhaps in the pages of a, circular or leaflet, or when spoken from a dais to a crowded room, might be illegal. It was not illegal when the New York Times published published the same words as a record of the trial. So it was a great strategy, and led them into kind of encounter after encounter with the prosecutors and with judges of various sorts. And they became pretty sharp legal actors themselves, which the judge in that case had to concede at the end. He's like, if only these really brilliant young people would use their brilliance for, other more loyal causes, sort of the argument of the judge.
I actually underlined this in the book, and I want to read like a few sentences from the book that captures this, sure, because that was also one of my favorite chapters. I thought it was absolutely incredible. So here I'm reading from the book. So Goldman and Berkman's performances in court belied the public image of anarchists as bomb-throwing foreigners. Goldman impressed the court with her oratorical skills. Berkman proved a quick student of procedure, challenging government witnesses on cross and making well-timed objections. "That is a first-class objection," Mayer, so the judge in this case, Julius Mayer, exclaimed at one point in spite of himself. "Sustained." "I had known Sasha for 28 years," Goldman recalled. "But Sasha as a brilliant lawyer was a revelation even to me, his oldest friend." This is an amazing quote that really captures how brilliant these minds were and how skills they were at mounting their legal defense. I just thought it was a remarkable quote.
Yeah, and they had a real appreciation for the nitty-gritty of things like jurisdiction. Of, they would learn the process by being, objected to, and then sort of adapt in the court. They thought hard about, as other anarchists did, about how to what motions to make or whatever, so that they could control what forum they would be in. Many of the anarchists, I have several different characters in the book who were, wherever they were, which is often in prison, like in Atlanta, wanted to make sure that if they were going to be deported, that they would be deported from New York. Why? Because then they could see their family and friends at least one last time on Ellis Island. They didn't want to be deported out of Jacksonville, Florida, so there are all kinds of sort of savvy things, that they learned. And also they learned this through their encounters with the legal system. But they also, in the case of Berkman, this is a guy who spent so much time in prison. And what did he do in prison? He read, including read law stuff. So he's a classic jailhouse lawyer. Meanwhile, they both tell Weinberger, their lawyer, you're so naive to believe that that the Constitution is real. So it's, I like that exchange, that dynamic between them quite a bit.
So let's talk about Weinberger. You previously mentioned him, Harry Weinberger. So his understanding of the law was completely different from theirs. So he did sympathize with the anarchist movement, but he wasn't himself an anarchist. So could you tell us a little bit about how he came to form his ideas about the need to protect personal liberty and what kind of cases he ended up taking on?
So Harry Weinberger was a really different character from either Berkman or Goldman. which made their kind of chemistry of such great interest to me. So Weinberger grew up in New York City. He liked to say that he was born the same year that the Statue of Liberty was put up in New York Harbor, 1886. He grew up on the Lower East Side. His parents were from immigrants from the Austro-Hungarian Empire. They were Jewish. He was Jewish. His father was a fruit peddler, kind of classic occupation of newly arrived Jews from Eastern Europe. And Weinberger grew up in what I assume was a quite religious home, but I'm not sure. He does talk about sort of religion not taking hold with him. Instead, his religion really became the law, the Constitution, American ideals of liberty. He really treated the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, as a kind of scripture almost. And he got an education through the public schools and got a legal education in night school at NYU Law School. I reconstruct in the book how important that those night school classes were to the emergence of a kind of radical bar in New York in the early 20th century. But so he believed strongly that the he could make constitutional arguments that would save his defendants from deportation, from being incarcerated, that he could carry these cases all the way to the Supreme Court, which in several significant cases he did, and he expected to sort of prevail there. And there's no question that he lost. Goldman and Berkman both tweaked him for this, or for his belief that any other conclusion to these cases was possible. Berkman in one instance said to him in a letter, you know, regarding your brief, I would make it very brief, you know, and because there's nothing you could say that would, that would prevail in this moment. But notwithstanding that fact, he actually had an impact. One of the cases that he led ended up resulting in one of the most important dissents ever handed down from the Supreme Court bench. So, in a dissent very much in favor of First Amendment rights. So he had a real impact. He had strong beliefs in the Constitution. Right, I was just really taken with the way he and Emma Goldman in particular formed this deep friendship. And she sort of hoped that he would be converted to anarchism. And he hoped that she would see the light and realize that, that there really was something to the First Amendment and to ideas in the law like that. They both were disappointed in terms of those hopes, but they together helped to really create the impetus and very practical kind of institutional and organizational efforts that helped to give rise to civil liberties, modern civil liberties organizations in the United States. So that's a big story of the book.
And again, you use their correspondence for the book, and you have such gems there, including, if I remember correctly, right after, I think as she's being deported, she writes to him.
Yes, she writes to him from the boat, a series of letters that are really quite beautiful, I think, and just kind of meditating on where there's hope in the world and so on. And they took such a risk going to the Soviet Union or the Bolshevik, state, and with a hope that they might be able to bend this revolution towards anarchist ideas of freedom. And they and many other Russian Jewish anarchists who returned to what became the USSR. Returned to them either voluntarily or by being deported. Many of them were either exiled later, deported from Russia, or were jailed in Siberia and so on, that really faced or executed.
I don't want to spoil the ending of the book, but one thing that I found exceedingly moving and very important, and I think that's what you do very beautifully in the book, kind of reconstruct the also the personal aspect of the story, not just the ideological debates or the legal aspect of it, but also the emotional aspect of it. And because you have that a lot of correspondence materials, you're able to do this. And what I took away from the book is Goldman's really love and perhaps faith in the United States. Till the end, till she died. And I let it to the reader to discover where she was buried for those who don't know. But until the end, she held on to that love and that hope, despite everything that she endured. And to me, it's really an immigrant story of someone, you know, she faced the worst abuse, she was deported, but still, until she died, she really continued exhibiting this profound affection towards the country that had been, you know, her place for multiple decades. And that is exceedingly moving, I thought. So let's talk a little bit about this, but now stepping back from the personal and emotional aspect of it to talk more about the deportation and the relationship between the fight against the anarchist movement and changes in immigration law. So what exactly happened in immigration law at the time, and how was this tied to the question of citizenship? And here maybe we can pause a little bit on Goldman's own saga regarding her citizenship, and maybe also the different path that Berkman and Goldman followed in terms of their own citizenship status in the U.S.
So the question was about deportation and the uses of immigration law by the federal state to try to crush radicalism, anarchism in particular, but radicalism of all sorts. During the early 20th century. And the story really kind of takes hold after the execution of the assassination, rather, of President McKinley in 1901 by an avowed anarchist, Leon Czolgosz, who, notwithstanding his foreign-sounding name, had been actually born, was an immigrant, the child of immigrants. He had been born in the United States. As Congress, debated for months, what to do to wipe out anarchism, to really show Congress's resolve to do so. They tried a bunch of different proposals, ranging from federal laws that would have criminalized radical speech to various laws making violence towards public officials a federal crime. And again, the Congress sort of stopped at the brink of enacting such legislation. Because it seemed to exceed the federal government's own authority under the U.S. Constitution. But there was one area which the U.S. government really could claim plenary power, really full powers to govern, and that was in the area of immigration. And so in 1903, Congress enacted an Anarchist Exclusion Act that excluded immigrants of anarchist beliefs from entering the country. As you can imagine, this was incredibly difficult to enforce. In 1918, at the sort of end of World War I, and as the Red Scare is just emerging, Congress enacted another anti-anarchist act, which allowed for the deportation of non-citizens who held anarchist beliefs, really no matter how long they had been in the United States. And so this made it possible to deport someone like Alexander Berkman, who had no claims to citizenship, simply for his beliefs or non-beliefs, right? His disbelief in government, which is kind of an amazing idea. It also allowed, under the terms of the law, individuals who were members of organizations that, in the terms of the law, were anarchists, that essentially disavowed governments, that called for the overthrow of governments, whether those organizations were anarchists at all or communists, right, allowed the government to deport non-citizens merely for their membership in such organizations. And so this is the sort of foundation of the Palmer raids of 1919 mm-hmm. and 1920. The story of Emma Goldman and her relationship to citizenship is a really complicated one and really a quite dramatic one. And it shows how obsessed American leaders with her were with her all the way to the various, very highest levels of the government, including the Attorney General of the United States and the Secretary of Commerce and Labor. Like they're talking
they're
about how to deport.
They're obsessed with her case.
Obsessed with their case. And just to tell it in a very short form, and hopefully readers will discover the full story in the book, but they sought to destabilize her claim to citizenship, which she had by right of her marriage to a naturalized citizen. And this marriage didn't last for very long. It was when she was still a young immigrant worker in Rochester, New York, but she had never been officially divorced. And so she had this claim sort of in her back pocket, but she was loath to use it because as a good anarchist, she believed that she was a citizen of the world, not of any nation. But the existence of this possible claim really complicated all of her legal interactions with the state and made it hard to deport her initially, and it gave a kind of tool for Weinberger to use in one legal forum after another, from the Ellis Island deportation hearings into the courts, and even made this case he pushed this case to the Supreme Court. So it's a really kind of amazing story. But she did, as you said before, she really did come to think of America as her place and of New York City as her home. And being forced to leave this adopted home, where she had lived for 30 plus years, was heartbreaking for her. And for me, I have to say, reading on it all.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah, I'm sure. I think that the deep irony, of course, in her citizenship saga is that as someone who had rejected the institution of marriage as part of her anarchist worldview, she really held on to that claim until the end of her life to make a comeback to the U.S. pretty much. And so it's interesting, again, because I think that's the main theme of the book, right? Which is how these actors navigate like their own contradictions in their life when navigating the legal system and their own personal beliefs. And that I think is such a good illustration of the different points that you're making through the book. So we're almost done here, although there's much more to talk about. But as a Jewish historian, I cannot help asking a question about the Jewishness of those characters. Because we haven't talked about it so far, but I can't help thinking that this is very much an American story. I mean, there's, you know, no question about this, but also very much a Jewish story. You know, the three main characters of the book are Jewish. And it's not, I think it's significant that they are. I don't think it's random that they are. So can you maybe expand a little bit about the Jewish piece of the story and why you think, if you do, that the fact that these characters were Jewish, came from Central and Eastern Europe, informed the arc of the story that you're telling in the book?
Yeah, I mean, so they would say, you know, at the outset, if they were responding to this question, that they were, you know, secular Jews for sure. That they had rebelled against the religious traditions of their upbringings. Even Weinberger would say that if Weinberger had a religion, it was the Constitution and possibly the writings of a relatively obscure now political thinker named Henry George. But nonetheless, the fact that they were Jewish mattered in many different ways. The anarchist movement of which they were a part was as a movement grounded in immigrant communities, shaped by the different sort of ethnic succession of the immigration process itself. So in the 1880s, in the era of Haymarket, the anarchist movement in the United States was to a significant degree a German-American movement. By the 1890s, it was becoming a movement of Yiddish speakers, of immigrants from the Russian Empire in particular. By the 1900s, it had become also deeply embedded in Italian immigrant communities as well. And by the 1910s, it was really a movement in which you had these two significant ethnic groups involved, Jewish immigrants and Italian immigrants, and they sometimes overlapped, they sometimes corresponded, they sometimes were on the stage together. Jewishness for Weinberger, I've thought about this a lot. I think that part of the way that this shaped his approach to law was in the way in which constitutionalism and constitutional ideas and ideas about justice became his, you know, textual basis for claims to social justice, and were a way of sort of maybe reconciling some of the religious traditions and ideas of justice embedded in his Jewish community with his role and his aspirations and ambitions as an American. For Goldman and Berkman, at the very least, Jewish identity was crucial in terms of their followers, right? And the way in which they kind of built a movement of Jewish immigrants. And in the early 20th century, there's this really in the immediate pre-war years, there's a wave of Russian Jewish immigrants to the United States, another kind of wave. And there's a new generation that comes over at that time. And they're, you know, they're interested in Goldman and Berkman, but they're doing their own thing. They're, to some extent, even more radical and pressing against the system even more. But they, too, are Jewish, and they're connecting through Yiddish language periodicals, and through groups in which they are all they're all Jewish. And from the perspective of the state, the amount of anti-Semitism, just open anti-Jewish language in the records of the surveillance state is stunning, or maybe not surprising, but nonetheless kind of overwhelming. And I think the fact that so many of these folks and the workers to whom they spoke were Jewish was a kind of almost racial labeling, led to a kind of almost racial labeling of radicalism during the 19 teens.
I did wonder about this because in the book, I think you mentioned this in passing, the anti-Semitism, but you don't really expand on this much in the book. Mm. So I did wonder to what extent this, because I imagine that they might have been an association in the popular imagination between Jews and anarchists for the reasons that you just described.
Yeah.
So was that the case? And so if so, how did, you know, the bureaucratic, the administrative states fight against Goldman and Berkman, how did that impact the lives of ordinary Jewish immigrants who may or may not have been anarchist at all? So what were the broader repercussions of the fight against those two well-known anarchists for the broader communities of Russian Jewish immigrants and other Jewish immigrants?
So at the very least, it meant that Jewish workers who attended these events, whether they were in Chicago or in New York or in San Francisco, were under the watch of us operatives of the surveillance state, Department of Justice officials, private vigilantes who were during the war and its aftermath were submitting all kinds of sort of surveillance reports to the radical division of the Justice Department and the like. And then I think that my sense is that in the in the wider culture during this period, Jewish Americans were sort of one of the many ways in which they were sort of suspect in the eyes of the native-born elites was their association with radicalism. Notwithstanding the fact that it's also my sense that the majority of Jewish working people during this period didn't have time for radicalism, right? Or were seeking to sustain their families, to try to sustain their faith, to try to build community, and to sort of get educated and succeed. And so this is another way in which Weinberger is a nice kind of counterpoint to Goldman and Berkman, because he grew up and walked the same in very much in the same neighborhoods that they did, but he saw the world very differently.
Right.
So I think that's a partial answer, but I do talk about in the book the way in which these government surveillance reports become a kind of archive of anti-Semitic chatter of all sorts, kind of low knowledge and gossip that gets stamped by the federal state and put into the archives of the Bureau of Investigation.
And
it's from formative period.
That's a good point. And I actually feel like there's a lot more work that can be done on kind of state anti-Semitism, really anti-Semitism coming from within the bureaucracy. I feel like there's this far more done than can be done on this topic by American Jewish historians. I hope your book is kind of a starting point for this kind of investigation. On the topic of the Jewishness of this historical actors, one thing that struck me, which is in the book, but that's not your main interest. So for understandable reasons, you didn't delve into this, but the respectability politics kind of unfolding within the Jewish community, because you talk about Jews entering the legal profession, for example, as solo practitioners like Weinberger did, but you also have Jews entering the legal profession as judges. And there's a whole kind of like very much intra-Jewish dynamics at play here in the American courtroom. And it's fascinating to me that in the a criminal conspiracy case that you mentioned, the judge himself is Jewish. And I think Julius Mayer, he actually appears in my own research on Jewish divorce.
Nice.
In one of my cases, he actually tells the litigants the law of the land is the law, which is a Talmudic principle, but he pretty much uses the courtroom to use a Talmudic principle to tell them to obey American law. So there's just, again, I think for American Jewish historians,
wonderful.
Yeah. So much more to do with this kind of legal cases, which I think your book is a very nice opening into this topic. Before hearing your own concluding thoughts, I would love to hear a little bit about delving into the primary sources, because we talked about the correspondence. So I wondered how you come through this. I mean, I imagine it's a vast wealth of materials. So how you actually went about, using this material, reading, using it to the book. And if you have any advice for people who are writing this kind of social legal history about how they can use correspondences for this kind of historical work.
Yeah, I mean, this correspondence is pretty exceptional because these are, immigrant working class people who are also intellectuals, right? And they are, they have varying levels of literacy. Molly Steimer, who is a fantastic figure in the book, is far less adept at writing in English in particular than Emma Goldman, but her prose is really powerful. And seeing it on the handwritten on the page that I'm holding in my hand is just kind of amazing throughout. As far as the source base for the book, the heart of the core of the materials are the Weinberger papers, which are not digitized. And I actually think that was good for me. I got to spend a bunch of time in the Yale archives, many weeks over several years, just paging through these and taking digital photographs, but also Just absorbing the material, reading it, thinking about it, going back to letters I had just read. The drama in the Goldman correspondence as she's headed, you know, the struggle to avoid being deported is ongoing. And then I just wanted to turn the page, you know, and there was the next letter detailing this story, right? And in very conversational and human terms with her lawyer. That material was fantastic. But I was able to juxtapose this material or read it against the official records of the state. So the Radical Division files of the Justice Department, the surveillance state, the Immigration Bureau files, both of these collections, enormous collections, are now available in various digital forms, using Ancestry.com, the Ancestry Library, to get the manuscript censuses to figure out where people are living and when and how, what the immediate social fabric of their neighborhood was like. The Emma Goldman Papers Project that I already mentioned, very important. The papers of Lewis F. Post down in Washington, D.C. at the Library of Congress were very important. He was a figure in the Department of Labor who played a very dramatic and important role in the story. Newspapers were also really important. And then the court cases and legal briefs for these big trials. And the briefs, you know, went hundreds of pages, and the transcripts of the trial. So getting the blow-by-blow proceedings that transcripts of the proceedings that include evidence and testimony. So it was a real abundance of material, and full of drama, not just the usual kind of bureaucratic stuff.
It is truly a peach turner until the last page. I read it so fast. So it really, it is excellent, Michael, and I recommend it highly to all our listeners. Michael, do you have any concluding thought before we part ways?
No, just I hope that people read the book and enjoy the big story, and that it prompts them to think about the enduring problems of democracy and the rule of law and justice that are at the heart of this book. I really think that we are having a reckoning with many of these problems right at this very moment. So I hope it will speak to a wide readership.
It is a timely book indeed. Michael, it has been such a pleasure to host you today. And thank you to our listeners for joining us. Have a great day, everyone.
Thank you very much.